Good morning. Every year on Good Friday, we read the Passion account from John's Gospel. The Gospel Passion accounts of the Synoptics are each read in their respective years, so that you only hear the given Gospel every third year. And this is the year for the oldest and the briefest of the accounts, just as it is the oldest and briefest of the Gospels. The Gospel of Mark. There's already a plethora of riches built up in this text. If you read it, just looking at the footnotes in a good annotated Bible that will refer you back to all the quotes from the Tanakh. It's literally a collage of scriptural quotes put together to help us understand what's going on. And I have neither time nor inclination to do all of that with you today, but do it for yourself over the week. You'll find more than enough material for thought and study, for prayer and reflection and contemplation. What I would like to do is touch on just a couple of details that show how Mark weaves the major themes of his gospel through the passion narrative. Mark has two major themes. The first is the identity of Jesus. The second is the nature of discipleship. The first thing is who Jesus is. And Jesus reveals himself to us, or is revealed to us by God, gradually throughout the gospel. But with a touch of the good dramaturge, Mark tells you, the reader, at the very beginning, chapter 1, verse 1, the beginning of the good news of Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus is the Christ and is the Son of God. But this is only gradually understood by the characters inside the drama as it goes along. And I'd like to pick out a couple of details that reflect on that here in the Passion narrative. First of all, at the table, after the meal, Jesus takes the cup, says, "This is the cup of my blood, the blood of the covenant." A new phrase. It's the only time the word covenant is used in Mark's gospel. And of course, it ties this to that theme of covenant that we have been tracing all through Lent. It will be poured out. And that ties, of course, to that second reading, that wonderful hymn that Paul preserves for us in Philippians about Jesus not clinging to equality with God, but emptying himself, pouring himself out, and thus revealing himself as the Son of God, for it is God who pours God's self out on us in the creation, in the election, in the redemption, in the covenant. It will be poured out for you and for many. Many. That's a dangerous phrase in English because it suggests not all. That's why we don't use it in the consecration prayer. But in Aramaic, the phrase is more like the many. It's an idiomatic phrase for every damn body. It will be poured out for you and for every damn body so that sins may be forgiven. Now that's a key structural element for Mark, because that same phrase ties you back to chapter 10, verse 45, one of the critical central verses in Mark's gospel. After three attempts at explaining to them about the passion, three times the disciples are messed up, three times he's trying to make it clear again, he finally says, "Look, the Son of Man has not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for the many," every damn body. So this phrase ties that theme together and tells us who Jesus is, the one who pours out his blood for all of us. Second little detail in the garden. Jesus prays to God, and the prayer begins, "Abba, That's the only time that word is quoted in the Aramaic on the lips of Jesus in the whole Bible. It occurs two other times, once in Galatians and once in Romans. But it's on our lips, us praying in Jesus' spirit, cry out as he does. The only time it's on his lips is here. He used it all the time, of course, but mostly when the gospel writers referred to it, they translated it into Greek. Gospel's written in Greek, why not? Pater, Father. But here and only here, the original Aramaic is retained because it has the flavor, the intimacy, the closeness, the trust. It's more a dad word than a father word. What a strange time to call him dad. In the garden, in total fear, begging not to have to go through this. Praying to the same God whom you will address the next day, my God, why have you abandoned me? But nonetheless, here, of all places, there is this act of trust, this total confidence, Abba, in Mark alone. Thirdly, at the hearing, in all of the hearing scenes, the chief priests challenge Jesus. And in all of them, he answers them. But in the others, it's all ambiguous. He answers much as he answers Pontius Pilate here in Mark. You said so. What exactly does that mean? But here, both the question and the answer are very precise and unambiguous. The high priest says, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Well, you know the answer to that. That's the very question that was answered back in verse 1. Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus answers plainly and directly, "I am." But nobody's listening. That with which we've been striving all the way through the gospel is finally proclaimed from Jesus' lips. You, the reader, have known it since the beginning. God has known it. The voice from heaven has said it. Angels and devils have known it. Now Jesus announces it, and nobody believes it. He is condemned to death for blasphemy, for having said so. Wonderful, dramatic irony. Now again, at the trial, before Pilate, who is it that is released in Jesus' place? Mark is the first one to give us the name. Barabbas. Barabbas. Son of the Father. Now granted, Mark is writing for a Gentile community and does not presume a great deal of familiarity with Aramaic. But just a few verses before, he's quoted it for them in the Aramaic, Abba. And here you have Bar Abbas, son of the Father. Perhaps the ultimate irony. The one who is not son of the Father, but is named son of the Father, goes free. And the one who really is fully and completely the son of the Father goes to the cross. And as a result of that, you and I become the daughters and sons of the Father. And final detail on who is Jesus at the cross. At the cross, after his death, we finally have the revelation of the mystery. For the first time, a human being, other than Jesus himself, understands who Jesus is. Peter has gotten it half right back in chapter 8, "You're the Messiah." But he can't get to the Son of God part because he's unwilling to face the cross. Once the cross is a reality, it can be understood. Once his self-outpouring is evident, we can see who he is. And now, the centurion, the commander of the execution detail, a Gentile for God's sake, a pagan, says, "Truly, this was the Son of God." The revelation is complete. The revelation that can be understood only through the outpouring on the cross. That's little hints of Mark's "Who is Jesus" theme in the Passion narrative. The other theme, which I'll deal with much more briefly, who are we? What is the nature of discipleship? All through the gospel, the leading disciples come off as a bunch of blockheads. It's the little people, many of them anonymous, who show us what discipleship is. And so too here. There were thousands who listened to Jesus, hundreds who followed him, but only a dozen picked to be his companions. And of those 12, one has betrayed him, one has denied him, and the other 10 have run like frightened rabbits. They are nowhere to be seen. Who is there? Women, first of all. Just as in the heart of the gospel you have this inclusion between Peter's mother-in-law, who understands to come to serve, and the woman at the temple who puts in the 2 little coins and gives her life. So here we have, from the beginning to the end of the Passion narrative, faithful women. This anonymous woman — Mark loves anonymous women — who breaks open the jar of oil and anoints Jesus' head, as he says, "Preparing me in advance for my burial." To the 3 women who stand faithfully at the foot of the cross, all the men have fled, but these women are still there. And 2 of them, faithfully at a distance at the tomb. And they will be back after the Sabbath to anoint the body. These women show us what discipleship really means. And then one more unlikely character: Joseph of Arimathea. Now, in the other Gospels, they dress him up. They have to try to make him, claim him for one of us. You know, he's made to be a disciple, albeit a secret one, out of fear and so on. Not in Mark, where we hear of him for the first time. He's not a disciple. He's Joseph of Arimathea, in Hebrew, Ramathaim, the town that Saul came from. Saul was not the best remembered of Israel's kings. Being from Saul's town was not a high level of endorsement. But he was a member of the council, presumably elderly, presumably rich, as most of them were. And no indication that he was a disciple of Jesus at all. But he is an upright man, a man who knows and tries to follow the Torah. And the Torah says that when a person is executed, the body should not be left on the tree overnight, lest there be defilement. And knowing that, he goes to Pilate and asks for the body of Jesus, takes it down, wraps it, incurring corpse defilement in the process, in a linen sheet, and lays it in a tomb in accordance with the law. This simple act of compassion, this simple act of Torah righteousness, is what discipleship is supposed to be. And this person, who was not even a disciple of Jesus, much less one of the chosen 12, is a disciple when all of them have fled. All of that is set before us as we begin this Holy Week. Can we recognize Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God, in the outpouring of his blood that he makes for us to establish the new and everlasting covenant? And can we, like the women, like Joseph from Ramathaim, be faithful, be witnesses, be there as disciples? Sisters and brothers, let us pray.